to say it was a case that divided Italy down the middle is an understatement. A young American student, Amanda Knox, was convicted of the murder of her British roommate, Meredith Kircher, in prison for 4 years. And not many crimes in recent years have captured the public imagination quite as much as the murder in a little university town in central Italy. In fact, when Knox was acquitted last month, as you may recall, more than 500 members of the media arrived in the country to broadcast the news to the world. And Gladys, since the acquittal, which, let me remind you, was less than 5 weeks ago, those 11 books have already been published and at least one film is being made. That was at the last count. Today we look at some of the issues raised by the case, the many failings of the Italian court system, the underground depravity and clash of cultures in one of Italy's most beloved cities, and the mind-boggling issues for diplomats faced with such cases, and what Australians in foreign prisons can learn from the Amanda Knox case. Joining me, John Fullane, on the Blower from Paris, where he is correspondent for the Sunday Times. John attended the trials and appeal hearings and had access, and this is extraordinary, to Amanda Knox's diary and the complete case files to produce his book, Death in Perugia. And on the Blower from Bega in southeastern New South Wales is Martin Hodgson. Martin, as you know, is a human rights activist, senior advocate with the Foreign Prisoner Support Service. He coordinated the campaigns for many Australians in prison, missing and kidnapped overseas, and worked with the Bali Nine. And Martin was also approached by the Knox family for advice. Gentlemen, I welcome you. John, what's the latest we're hearing about Knox and the Kircher family?
Yeah, hello, Philip. Hello, Martin. Well, the latest is we're waiting for the next step in the Italian court system. We're waiting for the judges to explain the reasons for the acquittal of Amanda and her boyfriend, Raffaele, which will be by the end of the year. And the prosecution has already said that it will appeal against that acquittal. And so we're heading for a new trial by Italy's highest court, the Supreme Court, next year, possibly in the summer.
A new trial, but without someone standing in the dock.
That's right. Without Amanda, she's obviously back in Seattle, and her boyfriend Raffaele, who actually lives in southern Italy. It's been reported that he is thinking of going to study in America, so he also may end up not being in Italy for the trial, but they can be tried in absence under Italian law.
John, you've paid your dues by sitting through the whole process, but what are the issues you're trying to raise in retelling the story now?
Basically, it's to try and this is the first book that has come out since the acquittal, and it's grown out of 4 years of reporting for the Sunday Times on the case and interviews with people who haven't spoken before, including some of Meredith's friends. And basically what I'm trying to do is, there's been obviously masses of newspaper coverage, but it's to try and tell the full story from the beginning by describing what people did, what people thought, and what they said, to try and give the reader an idea of all the elements of the case and of the rebuttals against the case.
So the book, and having had a quick read, I must say it seems very balanced as well as being very detailed, allows the reader to respond to the central question, did they or didn't they?
Yes, that's right. I think with a case so complicated and so divisive, I think what I wanted to do anyway was to try and set out over the days, over the weeks and months, just what happened day by day, so that the reader can then make up their mind or try to make up their mind, because obviously it's very, very difficult to say what actually happened.
This is how one newspaper described the university town. As the trial unfolded before television cameras, so did the town's tawdry party scene, one where free-spirited students spent their study abroad semesters staggering drunk out of pubs into piazzas, searching for easy sex and partying till dawn. Now, we're talking about a town famous for its Etruscan tunnels, its early Christian art, for its chocolates. What was the sense that you got of the town while you were there?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think the description of the debauchery and the drunkenness and the wild sex is a bit of an exaggeration. Most students come to Perugia to study. Yes, they do have fun. One Italian newspaper described it as Ibiza. And it's true, there is a drug problem. It's enough just to walk through the city centre and you see dealers skulking in doorways, offering cannabis, etc. And there is quite a high number of drug-related crime in Perugia, which is obviously linked to the very strong foreign student presence and Italian student presence, of course.
Yeah.
But you know, it does remain a picturesque, largely unspoiled town, and it's not.
Well,
it's not
it must be suffering great torments of its own, you know, insofar as one can give a city a personality. I mean, the shame that's been brought upon it, much of which sounds unfair.
Well, it was noticeable that at the trial hearings, the various hearings, there were very few members of the Perugia, of the public. The Perugians, by and large, even though the local newspapers did give quite a big coverage to the case right through the first trial and the appeal hearings, the public stayed away. For them, I think, you know, talking to them, they feel it's not their affair, in the sense that it's a crime involving foreigners. Of course, we have Raffaele was convicted and then acquitted, but you know, they see it as something which pertains to the foreign student world, and there is a bit of a barrier between the Perugians and the foreign students.
I'm talking to John Verlaine, who's correspondent for the Sunday Times and author of the first of the many books on this extraordinary trial. John, in parenthesis, are you going to stick it out? Are you going to stay with the story as long as it runs?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... we have the Supreme Court trial next year. There are various other cases linked to Meredith's death. I'm just, to be honest, I'm just not certain that we'll get a definitive, precise explanation of how and why Meredith died from the Italian courts.
Yes, are you aware of the Lindy Chamberlain legal saga in Australia?
I haven't studied it, but read about it.
I just make the point that was also the way it went on and on and on, and in fact still lingers and resonates with a great many people refusing to accept what is manifestly obvious to most of us, that Chamberlain was innocent. But anyway, let's now bring Martin Hodgson into this. Martin, tell us about the Foreign Prisoner Support Service. What was it established to do, and how does it do it?
Good evening, Philip. Good evening, John. Look, it was established in the early 90s to assist Australians, firstly, who had got arrested or in trouble overseas, simply to fill a void that the government wasn't providing the service. That remains the case today, and our workload's grown to include everyone from around the world.
So the Knox family approaches you for assistance because you'd coordinated so many campaigns for Australians imprisoned overseas. Why did you refuse to continue with the case, Martin?
Well, I'd just concluded a case of an Australian who'd been in prison in Italy. The Italian justice system is enough to give you a headache. But the intrigue of the case brought me in to the Knox case, and it's hard to turn anyone away. But for me, it was the cultural clash. There are a lot of people in America advising the family, judges, journalists, solicitors, who were taking a real antagonistic line, not very complimentary of the Italian system, which may or may not be true, but it's not going to help someone before the courts. And I tried to give my advice, and it wasn't listened to. And this was very early on in the stage of the case, and I just couldn't feel I could continue with it.
Now, for every Amanda Knox, of course, Martin, there's a name we don't hear, many of them Australian, travellers in far-off lands who are in the slammer despite not breaking the law.
Yeah, that's sadly correct. There's an Australian, Mohamed Abbas, who is still in a prison in Egypt. He was kidnapped in 1999 by the police, the intelligence service there, and he's still there. And the Australian government has done nothing for more than 10 years. and you hear very little about him, and there's many others like him. So I think this is one of those cases that has got headlines, but we should remember there are many, many people who will never get an article written about them.
Can diplomats actually have much leverage in such situations?
They can if they choose to. Often I'm told by journalists who are new to an Australian being imprisoned overseas that DFAT can't do anything or a politician can't do anything. But it's actually not the case. Even though their charter says they won't, in 2002, John Howard diverted his aeroplane to the Maldives to intervene in a case, and the gentleman who was serving a life sentence was released.
Mm.
So it certainly can be done. It's a willingness to do it that is lacking.
You're hearing the voices of John Verlaine, correspondent for the Sunday Times and author of Death in Perugia, and Martin Hodgson, senior advocate with the Foreign Prisoner Support Service. Matters arising from Death in Perugia, and this is LNL on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia, and available for downloading. Let's stay with Martin before bringing John back into the discussion. You reckon that the first 48 hours of arrest are crucial, because in this time you can put a whole country offside by clumsy actions.
Yeah, I think we've certainly seen in a number of cases involving Australians where particularly the media has got involved very early on, unscrupulous media anyway. Chappelle Corby would be one example. And you see that in that case, the whole island of Bali, the locals, the police, the judiciary, were put offside very early. So there's some very important steps you have to take.
What are they, Martin? What should one do if you find yourself or your child in one of these situations?
Yeah, I think first what happens is that usually you'll get a consular visit, and you'll be given a list of lawyers by that consular official. They're generally not very good lawyers. So what you need to do is contact an organisation like ourselves, and we can recommend you lawyers who have experience dealing with these sort of high-profile cases. You also need to be able to manage the media, and preferably early on not say too much, and just let things settle down. And it's good to have a lawyer in Australia who can represent you here, because there's going to be all sorts of things that arrive along the journey.
Sometimes it would seem that the attempts to intervene get a bit over the top. Or, I mean, look at what looked like a competition between Gillard and Rudd over the 14-year-old Australian boy facing drug charges in Denpasar, and the fact that there we were on the telly looking at the Australian ambassador, no less, Greg Moriarty, personally intervening. Might that not put the Indonesians' nose out of joint?
Yes and no. I think in most cases, yes, it wouldn't be the best thing to do. In the case of a minor, in a country like Indonesia, I think it was good the government acted swiftly. I think that is also partly to do to criticism that we've levelled at them in the past for not acting at all, and perhaps they went too far this time. I think the problem this time was that it was clouded in that competition between Rudd and Gillard.
Yeah.
That is, you know, in the broader political issue in Australia, and that was very unfortunate. And also the certain media have not done a good job, or not a very responsible job at reporting it, given that he is a minor and his face should have been concealed and his identity should have been kept a secret.
John, bringing you back from Paris, one is aware that not every country in the world has the same adversarial justice system as we in the US, and I suppose the UK do. I'm aware of the ongoing investigative approach, say, in the French system. How does the Italian justice system work? What makes it different?
Well, as you mentioned, the slowness is one factor, and I think that's partly due to the way the Italian justice system grew out of the Second World War and grew as a response to try and prevent the kangaroo courts of the dictator Mussolini. And so the rights of defendants are actually guaranteed quite strongly, in the sense that there are lots of barriers for the prosecution to hurdles for the prosecution to jump over. There are lots of different hearings which go before different courts, different judges.
Are you saying it's slow but sure, or simply slow and allowing strategic possibilities to unfold?
Yeah, I mean, I think slow and bewildering, in the sense that we've seen in various very big crime cases since the war in Italy, you get one solution before the case even comes to trial, because much stuff is leaked to the press by both the investigators and the defense lawyers. Then it goes to trial, and you get an acquittal or a conviction, and then go to appeal. That's overturned, and then it's again go to the Supreme Court. We've seen it in massive killings, the huge the Vatican the Vatican links to the God's Bank. Roberto Calvi was found hanged in London.
We've also seen the sort of confusing outcome, say, in the murder of Pasolini, or the Bologna railway station bombing.
That's right, and of course it's all infuriating for the families of the victims, because they're given one version and then given another one. And I think part of the problem is partly the whole structure of the judicial system, which is in desperate need of reform. And the fact that it's very slow, in the sense that it's not like in the Anglo-Saxon system, in the sense that you don't have a trial held over, say, 5 days or 2 weeks every day. It can be spread over months and months, with obviously for the actual verdict, the judges and the jurors, you know, right up to the verdict, they're going home and sort of reading the papers, watching TV, talking to their friends about it.
John, conspiracy theories abound in famous US trials. I guess they're pretty much a part of the scene in Italy as well.
Yes, absolutely. It's a national pastime to try and find explanations for, you know, counter-explanations whenever officialdom or anybody tells you something. Of course, in many cases, what officials tell you may not be completely the truth, but I must say, you know, I see that many of these conspiracy theories are actually built on nothing. I think if you don't have hard evidence pointing to something, then why discuss it?
Might I ask you one question before I let you go? What are the Black Chronicles, or what are Black Chronicles?
I think it refers to Cronaca Nera in Italian, and it's basically the word used to describe the reams and reams of newspaper coverage and books published about crimes, about the most horrific crimes since the war. And there's a huge there does seem to be a huge public demand in Italy for this coverage, which you don't necessarily find in other countries.
John, I said that was your last question. I lied. How would this have played out had the murder occurred in a US college town, do you think?
I think it would have been very different, in the sense that we would not have got what some people would call trial by media. I don't think as much evidence for or against would have been leaked by all the sides. And I think we'd have got a much faster solution, in the sense of a faster verdict, with fewer possibilities or likelihoods of appeal.
Martin, you write that a political controversy should not be started under any circumstances, because while you can be found guilty in the court of public opinion in Australia and go for it, it's different in a foreign country.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult if you escalate the issue out of which you cannot control, and once it's escaped the control of your legal team, anything can happen. I think we've seen that, whether it's been in Southeast Asia with Australians involved. One thing we try to do as an organisation is prevent it becoming a political game. The case I was working on before I was approached by the Knox family in Italy was one that had the potential to become very political, because it involved Israeli officials and drug smuggling. And so you have to be very, very careful that these cases don't become a political slanging match, because once that happens, then the individual will be sacrificed to the greater good of each political side.
Thank you, gentlemen. John Fullane, correspondent for the Sunday Times, author of Death in Perugia, which will be followed by at least another 10 books and a couple of feature films. Martin Hodgson, senior advocate with the Foreign Prisoner Support Service. And now, as promised, we're going to talk to Lady Fiona Carnarvon.